1458, Candace Hensley versus Weston Hotel.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jonathan Gaskin, and may it please the court. I'm here today to represent the appellants, Ms. Candace Hensley and Mr. Timothy Hensley. Today, there's an issue before the court that probably will govern the remaining of our issues, and that issue was the issue of jurisdiction, which was sent back down by this honorable court to the Court of Appeals. To the district court to make a determination of citizenship of all the defendants. That issue was carried with the case. And today, what I'd like to address is that issue of jurisdiction. It's our position that jurisdiction was actually destroyed by the intervention of Hartford Casualty Insurance, which intervened into the case as a matter of right. Hartford intervened in this case under OCGA 9-1124.
By matter of right, you mean indispensable party?
Yes, sir, as a matter of right.
I understand. If it's an indispensable party and there's not diversity, that goes back to state court and you get the big verdict as opposed to the little verdict here. We understand that.
Yes, sir.
So the question is, why is the district court's determination wrong, clearly erroneous about that? We sent it back for that. The district court considered it and came up with the findings.
The district court came up with the findings that, in essence, jurisdiction was established through the diversity of citizenships of the original parties to the case.
And the affidavit, right?
Come in, yes, sir. And the district court also found by the intervention of Hartford that diversity was actually destroyed. It was destroyed, and I believe document 59, Judge Ginsburg, in that order said that it was actually destroyed. It was during the intervention. His court order actually said that Hartford had an absolute right, an unconditional right to intervene. I believe it was under OCGA 34-9-11-1, and that allows someone to come in as an insurance company, which Hartford did. They paid a substantial amount as far as workman's comp to our client, but that's a statutory right that makes it a right, a matter of right, not a permissive right to intervene.
But they're not here.
They're not here, Your Honor.
But that the district court order said permissive, which was puzzling to me because, as we're talking about now, I mean, Hartford moved to intervene as of right. So are we supposed to just take that was an error in the district court's order?
Well, Your Honor, the district court said that it's ordered pursuant to 34-9-11-1B and 9-11-24A, and that's the intervention as of right. 9-11-24B is a permissive intervention language. Now, he found that they had an absolute and unconditional right to come in to this case. It all rises out of the same transaction, the facts, the nucleus of the case, and the statutory right under the 34-9-11 allowed them to come in. Now, the findings of the court that come back, and as far as the diversity of all of the citizen, it's sort of baffling to us because in that finding, the language seems to tend to shift from his order of on document 58 that says an absolute and unconditional right to intervene. It sort of shifts and comes into a language where he's sort of saying, well, now, you know, because the diversity was destroyed and now, you know, it's before the Court of Appeals, well, maybe it was permissive intervention, just send it back to us.
I'm sorry, how can this not be intervention as of right? How can it not be that the outcome of this litigation may impair or impede Hartford's ability to recover the amount of money it's paid out? I mean, if this litigation ends up with a judgment for the defendant, Hartford loses everything.
And I absolutely.
So it may impair or impede Hartford's ability to enforce its interest and collect the money it's already paid out to the plaintiff.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. That is absolutely our position on that as well.
Your position is it's intervention as of right, and that's why the diversity problem is so important. Maybe we should hear from them about how this can possibly be permissive when they get up.
But I'm struggling with the same thing you are, which is in Document 58, the district court says Hartford has an unconditional right to intervene pursuant to 34.9.11b. But then when we sent it back, its order on remand, it does mention permissive intervention. So I was viewing that as an error.
And that's exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor. I don't understand how it can go from
maybe a Scrivener's error.
Well, it seems like it's fashioned, the report back to the court as far as jurisdiction, it seems like it was fashioned more to persuade the court, well, maybe if you send it back, I can use the permissive under 9/11/24B, the language under that, and just dismiss Hartford and then impose summary judgment on the...
Regardless of that, if the district court says this is intervention, permissive intervention, and it's not, we're not bound by the district court's error.
Yes, sir.
We can say, and we've got to determine jurisdiction, the district courts as well as our own, derivative from the district courts on the diversity question. All right, this is intervention as of right. So, is there complete diversity with Hartford in it? And if there isn't complete diversity with Hartford in it, then no jurisdiction. Isn't that where we are?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. That is where we are. And that is our position. If Hartford's in it.
All right. So, assuming you've said all you want to say on that, explain to us why you believe that Hartford's diversity hasn't been established.
Your Honor, by them intervening into the case, diversity has been established because Hartford is actually a Connecticut corporation and Merit is actually a Connecticut corporation. And at the onset of the case, Merit come in, when we named the defendants, we named Weston, a subsidiary of Marriott International. We actually named Weston Hotel Management. And when those were served, Merit come in and said, hey guys, y'all have made a mistake here. And they did it in their special answer, in their answer and special appearance. Y'all have made a mistake. We are actually the defendants here. And in essence, they implied in, so to say, and they filed the answer. Well, understandably, it's a special answer and it's just challenging jurisdiction of the court. But thereafter, Merit took substantial steps to come in and participate throughout litigation. Not only did they file a special answer, they waited a period of time and they didn't file a motion to strike as a defendant. They didn't file a motion to dismiss a defendant. They filed a motion for dismissal as a forum nonconvenience. And they didn't specifically incorporate that they reserved the special answer and the privileges under a special answer in that motion. So in essence, what they did, they stepped in as a special answer, now it becomes a general answer, and they were properly served. And what we did at that is we moved to amend the complaint we actually amended the complaint to create a misnomer. Now, understandably, if you're gonna add and drop a party, you've got to seek leave of court. But you do not have to seek leave of court to amend the complaint to correct a misnomer. You're not really adding a party, you're just correcting a name. And it was very open and obvious to Merit once we served Weston Hotel as subsidiary Marriott International. And it was very clear that when we served Weston Hotel Management
that at some point they were contacted and said, hey, we're getting sued, but it's you guys. And at that time, Merit did come in, and they said, hey, y'all, we're the real defendants. Y'all mistakenly named. And we corrected that by amending the pleadings, Your Honor, and Your Honors. We credited that. So that being said, that established the diverse, that's destroyed it there. That's when...
Because Hartford, and as I understand it, Merit are citizens of the same state.
Yes, sir.
And so Hartford was the dog in the manger, basically, on the diversity issue. Once it comes in, and if it, particularly if it's an indispensable party, discussion over if its citizenship is right. But the question is, that is the reliance by Merit on the affidavit of Russo, did the district court make a mistake about that? Isn't that what it turns on?
Well, Russo testified that Merit is obviously a Connecticut corporation in and of itself when established in jurisdiction.
Yeah, and they say that's not enough.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Your opponent says that's not enough.
Well, we did say that's not enough because Russo was actually not a member of Merit. Russo, it's sort of like they went outside the corporate structure and got affidavits of people who knew or may have known about the corporate structure of Merit. And we raised that objection. Obviously, it was overruled. But that being said, it still doesn't negate the fact that Merit's come in. Merit's pushed into this litigation and has participated throughout litigation. And it still doesn't negate the fact that in the original order, Your Honor, Grinsberg actually said an absolute and unconditional right to come in. So at that point, diversity was destroyed. I mean, and at that point, obviously, it kicks in 28 U.S.C. 1367, B specifically. And what that says is, if that happens, and subject matter jurisdiction is destroyed, the court cannot exercise any supplemental jurisdiction. And that's the issue here. The court, in essence, from the court order on until this point, actually exercised without jurisdiction or any authority to make any decisions. And that's been quite a period of time. I think it was January of 2021. And I am correct. That was the 27th day. From that period on, it's our position that he just lacked jurisdiction to handle the matter.
If you want to save your time for rebuttal, you need to conclude.
Yes, ma'am. I can, please.
Ms. Gable?
Good morning. May it please the court, Laura Gable on behalf of the appellees. I'll begin by addressing the jurisdictional issue. We do not contest that Hartford's motion to intervene met the requirements for intervention as a matter of right under Rule 24A2. I believe that this issue really turns on whether Hartford was an indispensable party under Rule 19. Under Rule 19A, the court must determine if a party is a required party who should be joined if feasible. Hartford is arguably a required party because the dismissal of Hartford's claim from this action would impair Hartford's ability to protect its subrogation lien. Then, under Rule 19B, if a required party cannot be joined because joinder would divest the court of jurisdiction, as it would in this case, the court must determine whether, in equity and good conscience, the action should proceed among the existing parties or should be dismissed. In other words, whether the party is indispensable. Rule 19 lists four non-exclusive factors for the court to consider in making its determination. The first factor is the extent to which a judgment rendered in the person's absence might prejudice that person or the existing parties. And we can see that this factor does weigh in favor of indispensability. A judgment rendered in Hartford's absence might impair its ability to enforce its subrogation lien. However, other factors weigh in favor or against, rather, indispensability. One factor is whether a judgment rendered in the person's absence would be adequate. The plaintiffs do not seek any recovery from Hartford, and Hartford's presence is in no way necessary to decide the controversy between the plaintiffs and the defendants. So that factor weighs against indispensability.
But it is necessary to preserve Hartford's interest.
Yes, correct.
See, that's the first factor.
Yeah, the first factor. But I the factors and the factors. It's just hard for me to wrap around any kind of equitable notions. The idea that a party who has a right, recognized legal right, to a particular interest can be divested of that interest for the convenience of the other parties in a federal forum, when there's a state forum in which everybody's rights can be taken care of or adjudicated.
We believe that equity also, of course, needs to be considered from the standpoint of the defendants. And while I agree with your point, in the 2 years between the date of loss and when the plaintiffs initiated their suit, Hartford did not take any action to protect its lien under Georgia law. It had the option of filing suit against the defendants in its own name or in the name of Mrs. Hensley when plaintiffs did not file an action after a year after the date of loss, and Hartford elected not to do so. It also had the option of entering into an agreement with the plaintiffs to preserve its lien short of intervention.
But let me ask you about that, because you've mentioned that in your briefs about Hartford entering into an agreement with the plaintiffs. But the plaintiffs are not required to enter into any such agreement with Hartford, correct? There's no obligation.
Yes, and I am not sure, what the workers' comp policy says as to that effect. As far as I know, no.
And all parties have agreed, at least for the purposes of Rule 24, that the Hensleys could not adequately protect Hartford's interests, right?
Yes.
So even if there was some obligation to enter into an agreement, all parties are agreeing that the Hensleys aren't adequately protecting Hartford's interests. So I'm not sure how that point that, hey, maybe they could enter into agreement really works in your favor. But back to the timeliness, I guess you're arguing that it took Hartford a while to intervene, but you didn't oppose Hartford's intervention in the proceedings below, correct? Like, you didn't raise the timeliness issue.
That is true.
So haven't you waived any timeliness argument?
Untimely in asserting an untimeliness defense.
I suppose that Hartford's intervention wasn't strictly untimely. We are more arguing from an equity perspective.
And is there any evidence of when Hartford became aware of the lawsuit? I mean, did they know about it 2 years ago, or did they know about it when it was filed, and then they waited 2 years, kind of sat on their hands, or did they, when they found out about it, act fairly promptly as far as Hartford's concerned? Do we have any evidence about that?
I do not know the answer to that. What I do know is that Hartford began making workers' comp payments to Mrs. Hensley between the date of loss and when the plaintiffs filed suit. So,
well, that's why we're here, is that they made workers' comp payments. But just because workers' comp payments are made does not necessarily mean that a lawsuit has also been filed, correct?
Correct. They just could have taken steps to protect their lien before suit was filed.
Well, I guess that's what I'm trying to get at, is you're making an equity argument here, but it seems like we don't have enough information to know whether that's a valid equity argument. If we don't know anything about when Hartford had notice, the mere fact of workers' compensation payments to somebody is not enough notice that that person is then filing a separate lawsuit to recover monies that might be subject to a lien.
That is true, Your Honor.
Okay.
Plus, if there's, and there is, unless there's something in workers' comp law to the contrary, they have no obligation to enter such an agreement with Hartford. And they're wanting to go back to state court. So they're not going to cure your problem for you. And I don't think the law requires them to do that.
Understood. Assuming that Hartford is not indispensable under this Rule 19 balancing test, we believe that it's clear, and it seems that the plaintiffs do not contest that the district court would not have jurisdiction to hear Hartford's claim. There's no diversity jurisdiction, no federal question, and there is no supplemental jurisdiction under 1367B. And if that is the case, if Hartford is not indispensable and there was no supplemental jurisdiction, then it is our position that the district court correctly determined that its judgment be vacated and that the case be remanded so that the court could vacate its grant of Hartford's motion to intervene, dismiss Hartford from the case, and enter summary judgment for the defendant.
But so you would concede if we find that Hartford is indispensable, that's not going to happen, correct? That this is going to go back to state court?
I don't believe that the 11th Circuit has ever addressed the connection between lack of supplemental jurisdiction under 1367B and the indispensability question under Rule 19. But it does seem that other jurisdictions which have addressed the issue have said that regardless, even if there is no supplemental jurisdiction under 1367B, we still do need to consider indispensability under Rule 19. Yes.
And sometimes we do get to decide issues for the first time.
Yes. I'd like to move on to the issue of whether the district court properly granted summary judgment for merit on the grounds that the Hensleys did not obtain leave of court to amend their complaint to add merit as a defendant while the case was still pending in Georgia State Court, which rendered their complaint ineffective against merit. The Hensleys' arguments as to their correcting a misnomer and as to merit acknowledging service of the complaint both fail. For a party named in a complaint to be considered a misnomer for the real party in interest, it must be reasonably recognizable as the real party. Weston Hotel, a subsidiary of Marriott International, Inc., is not reasonably recognizable as Merit Hospitality, LLC. Merit is a distinct legal entity unrelated to Weston Hotel, WHM, or Marriott. That the amended complaint retained Weston Hotel as a named defendant in addition to Merit also indicates that the amendment served to add a new and distinct party and not to correct a misnomer. As for the service issue, Merit was never served with the initial complaint. It did not acknowledge service. It specially appeared to file an answer to the initial complaint in which it asserted the defenses of insufficient service of process and lack of personal jurisdiction. Thereafter, Merit never waived those defenses, but repeatedly asserted them in its filings and arguments.
What about removal? The fact that Merit removed the case, does that constitute a waiver?
No, it does not.
Why not?
I do not believe that that was the type of overt action that would constitute a general appearance, for example, or which would otherwise cause it to, I guess, which would supersede its prior special appearance, particularly because in the notice of removal, Merit again asserted that it was contesting insufficient service of process and lack of personal jurisdiction.
Is there any authority on that point?
I have not found any authority either way, I'm afraid. The Hensleys note that after Merritt filed its special appearance and answer, WHM moved to dismiss the complaint on form on convenience grounds, and as required under Georgia law, WHM filed a stipulation in which all of the defendants waived their right to assert a statute of limitations defense in the event that the suit was dismissed for form nonconvenience. Merritt did stipulate to waive that statute of limitations defense if the case were dismissed on form nonconvenience grounds, but this stipulation didn't serve as a general appearance that superseded that prior special appearance and caused it to waive its service and jurisdiction defenses. None of the cases cited in the Hensley's brief support such a conclusion. As for the issue of the affidavits and the consideration of those affidavits on limited remand, assuming that the defendants did need to prove their jurisdictional allegations by a preponderance of the evidence, they did so in the form of the Russo and Bleakley affidavits. The Hensleys did not present any evidence to counter the affidavits. Thus, the affidavits were unrebutted, and the defendants did prove their jurisdictional allegations by a preponderance of the evidence. In the Hensley's reply brief, they cite this court's decision in Williams versus Best Buy. In that case, the court articulated the proper procedure for a district court to determine on removal whether the amount in controversy satisfies the statutory requirement for diversity jurisdiction. It expressly approved of a district court's consideration of summary judgment type evidence relevant to the amount in controversy at the time of removal. The Russo and Bleakley affidavits are exactly the kind of summary judgment type evidence that may assist a district court in making jurisdictional determinations, and the district court could properly consider those affidavits on limited remand. If the court does not have any other questions, I will defer to our brief for arguments on any other issues. We ask that this court dismiss Hartford's claim and affirm the final judgment of the district court in its entirety. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Your Honors, just addressing a couple of issues real quick. The plaintiffs have not entered into any kind of agreement with Hartford. And Hartford's intervention come in, assumably when they gained knowledge that this case was actually pending before this honorable court or the district court, so to say. The issue really arises on this Merritt. How did Merritt get in? When they come in, is it a special appearance? Is it a general appearance? This has been addressed, and we addressed in our brief, and we quoted the same language in our brief and out of this case, National Office Partnership LP versus Stanley. This case, this unpublished case, Maffell versus Ocean Carrington Green, is a case that comes to light here in the last few weeks, and it was a case actually heard in the Northern District of Georgia, Atlanta Division, the same court that the Hensley case is in. And this case is actually quotes Hensley. And then it does say, this case says, in Hensley, the law requires a court order when it comes to adding or removal parties, and removing it to federal court cannot cure that. And we understand that. We didn't move this. The plaintiffs didn't move this. We weren't form shopping. When Hartford come in, we could easily, we just didn't form shop in this. We didn't have no agreement. But this case quotes Hensley, and that's what it says. But it also goes on and say, and this judge panel, this is one of Judge Grinsberg's colleagues, it goes on and says there's a key exception to this rule. However, if the real defendant was properly served in knowledge service, plaintiff can amend the complaint, correct the misnomer, set forth the correct identity, of that defendant. We don't have to get leave of court to do that. Well, Merritt come in and said, we're the real defendant. And at that time, we served them. And they were served, and they acknowledged service. They filed the special answer. They come into this, and that special appearance and that answer by our position transferred over to a general appearance when they moved Western Hotel Management was not the one that filed for the dismissal. Merritt come in state court and filed for the dismissal on behalf of Western Hotel Management and Marriott International and themselves for form of nonconvenience. They took an affirmative step and acknowledged service. Not only did they acknowledge service, they participated in the litigation. So the argument that they haven't been properly served or they shouldn't be a defendant, I don't think that applies here. I think they've participated for 4 years in this litigation. Now, as far as the issues of summary judgment, our issue is that the court has taken and said, well, Merritt wasn't a proper party, so they're not in, so the diversity is this. But he specifically said there's no genuine issue of material fact in finding that on a based on what appears to me to be a technicality that he is saying that as far as Merritt coming in and the rest of the defendants, that technicality prevents us from arguing that, in fact, there was a 7-foot, 7-inch rise, which our client fell on, sustained brain damage, facial damage. It hasn't been 3 weeks ago. She just had to have a titanium jaw put in because of this. She's still going through surgeries because of this. But he took that away from us based what he says on a mere technicality, which we amended and corrected at the onset of litigation. So it's our position, Your Honors, that the district court has erred. It's our position that once Hartford did come in, they were indispensable. They are a necessary party. They cannot protect their interest in this. We're not going to protect their interest in it. There's no agreement to that. With that being said, respectfully, Your Honors, we'd ask that you overrule the district court's determination on all matters, no more specifically no jurisdiction, and we ask this case be remanded back down to the Gwinnett County State Court. On behalf of my client, which she wanted me to extend her appreciation to all you all hearing this, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, counsel. Yes, ma'am. Court is adjourned until 9 a.m. tomorrow. All right.